Okay, so this is Bio 231, Human Anatomy, and it is Wednesday, September 17th, and we started talking about bones, and in particular, we looked at some bone tissue, and we were actually now moving into the axial skeleton. So you should probably have an idea, what is the axial skeleton as opposed to another part of the skeleton? What's another part of the skeleton besides axial? Appendicular, yeah, and there's a nice picture in your book that's color-coded so you can see the difference between the appendages compared to the axial skeleton. And let's see, what else did we talk about last time? I think we talked about a disease process that we will all get if we're lucky enough to live long enough. What's that?
Osteoporosis.
That's right. Who is more susceptible to that, men or women?
Women.
Women are, because they have thinner, daintier bones. Right, but again, if you're a male with thinner type bones, you're more susceptible than other males that have thicker density bones when they're younger, right? And if you're a woman and you're blessed with big, thick bones to begin with, then you can afford to lose more calcium as you grow older, so you're less susceptible. So everybody doesn't have the same susceptibility, but it's kind of a strange disease process because everybody to some degree or another will suffer from it. And in our population, that's very rare, that everybody will suffer from some kind of condition. And why is it rare that the whole human population doesn't come down with the same disease? Because it's a diverse population, that's right. Everybody's different. All right, and we're going to see how that happens later on in the class. Okay, so I defined for you last time just some nomenclature, how we like to define landmarks on bones. And we also talked about what the function is of those various landmarks. So, for instance, one kind of landmark is a process. What's the function of a process?
Muscle
attachment. And another kind of landmark is a hole. What's the name for a hole in a bone?
Foramen.
What's the function of a foramen? It's a, in one word, passageway. It's a passageway. All right, and then an articulating surface. What's the name for an articulating surface? There's a condyle. So what's the function of a condyle? It's for articulation, right? It's for holding two bones together and keeping them from grinding each other down. Let's see what else. A depression. That's a fossa. Yeah, people might say fossa. Fossa, I say fossa. And that's for holding something. Yeah, holding something. So we're going to see some important fossa today. And I think I made another point last time, and that is, bones are pretty easy to know, just a little bit of repetition, but make sure you go to lab and look at the three-dimensional bones or come to my office hours when I hold them in the lab and look at the bones, because you can't learn bones very well if you just look at pictures of them. So it's really good if you can come to lab, pick them up, look at them, turn them around, model them on yourself, turn them just in the right way so that they fit on your body. Then your mind will incorporate that information a whole lot better. You'll have better recall, and you'll be able to recognize these different bones. But we're going to look at some stuff in lecture nonetheless. So all the stuff that's on the web is helpful once you go to lab and learn it. But don't rely on pictures to help you prepare exclusively for a practicum, because that's just not going to work. Right? You just won't recognize stuff. Okay, so I forgot exactly how I wanted to start this, so make sure you go to lab. Okay, I got off on a little tangent here. Make sure you go to lab, do that lab stuff. Okay. All right, well, it might come back to me what it was. All right, so here are the bones of the face versus bones of the cranium. So the cranium are all the bones that protect what structure? The brain, that's right, the brain. So we have the brain inside the cranium. And facial bones don't protect the brain. They just allow you to breathe and to articulate, right, and to eat, things of that nature. So try to figure out which bones belong to the cranium, which bones belong to the face. Like, for instance, this nasal bone right here. What's that?
Face.
That's a facial bone, right? And the mandible. That's a facial bone as well. That's not holding the brain in position. The mandible is also noteworthy because, does anybody know why the mandible is noteworthy? Because of its function. It's the only bone of the head that has this particular function. That's right, it moves. It's the only bone of the head that moves. right? So it can, what's the motion that the mandible can do? It can do four motions. It can elevate. It can depress. It can, I think we went over motions of bones. Didn't we go over motions of bones? Oh, we haven't done that yet. That's in muscles, right? Oh, maybe muscle chapter. It can protract. We can stick your, but be careful, don't chip a tooth when you do that. You can stick your jaw out, and you can also retract. You can pull your jaw in. So those are basically the four kinds of motions. So that's what's noteworthy about the mandible here. All right. So the mandible has a hole in it. Do you see it? Yeah, I sort of see it. That's the mental foramen. There, let's try that. Maybe not quite so bright. Mental foramen. There is, here's the body of the mandible and the angle of the mandible, and this part of the mandible that's at a 90 degree bend from the body of the mandible right here, this is what we call the ramus, right? So we tried to define what a ramus was last time. Okay, and we have, this is what forms the temporomandibular joint, because here is the temporal, oh, I remember what it was I was going to say. Okay, so here's the temporal bone, and here's the mandible, so this is the temporomandibular joint. So don't forget, we can take two different words in anatomy and stick them together if in reality there's a relationship between them. But when we spell the word or say the word, what do we have to do when we create a word? We add that O. So temporomandibular joint. We hardly ever say that, really, because we usually just say TMJ, which is what? Temporomandibular joint. Okay, and that's kind of a problematic joint in some people, and probably the best person to talk to would be, in terms of a healthcare provider, what kind of person would be good to talk about your TMJ joint with?
Dentist.
A dentist, that's right. Okay. So you might not think of that, but that's really a good person to talk to. All right, so what I wanted to mention is, before I got off on a subject, bones are relatively easy to know. It's just a little bit of repetition. Go to lab, pick them up, look at them, look at the disarticulated bones. And it's going to be very helpful for the rest of the class because a lot of other structures in your body are named after the bones in that particular region. And I think I did mention this last time. For instance, there are different lobes of the brain. And what can you tell me about the name of the lobe of the brain that's right underneath the parietal bone? Right. And probably you haven't even looked at the brain yet, right? But that would be the parietal lobe. And the lobe that is closest to the occipital bone is going to be the occipital lobe. So by learning bones, you learn all kinds of stuff. And talking about the appendicular skeleton, which is not what we're going to look at today necessarily, but here is your forearm. You got two bones in your forearm. And the lateral one is called the radius. Guess what the name of the nerve is that's over there? That's lateral. Yeah, radial nerve. Guess what the name of the artery is over here? It's a radial artery, right? So make sure you know all the pieces of your bones because it will make life, the names of the bones and different parts of a bone, because it will make life a lot easier for you later on. Okay. So in lab, make sure you can identify all of these different bones. This is a nice exam figure. It's very easy to photocopy and put on the exam. So make sure you can label each one of these things and maybe even know what the function is. All right, like the styloid process right here on the temporal bone. That's for
muscle
attachment, right? And the mastoid process, that's for
muscle
attachment, and that's going to make life really easy if you know that when we get to muscles, because we're going to learn where muscles attach to different bones, and you'll have a nice clear picture in your mind where those muscles go, and then you'll know what the action of the muscles is too. You'll be able to figure that out. You won't have to memorize everything. Okay. So what do we call this, the general name for a joint between these flat bones and the cranium? That's a suture, right? And you have to know some names of sutures, right? All right, so the squamous suture right here, the lambdoidal suture right over here, occipital mastoid suture, and then we have the coronal suture right up over here. And in lab, I think you have to know one kind of minor one, unless you bump your face really hard. It's the nasofrontal suture. That's the suture between the nasal bones and the frontal bone right here. Okay. The way that we name processes on bones, so for instance, here we have a nice cheekbone or zygomatic, and we see that there's a number of processes. There's part of the zygomatic that moves medially and touches the maxilla. Here's a part that moves, what, superiorly and touches what bone? The frontal bone. And then the same zygomatic bone has a process that courses posteriorly and actually touches the temporal bone. And there is nomenclature that we use to describe these various processes of a bone, right? And so in every case is going to be what bone? Where's the cursor? It's the zygomatic bone, but we have three different processes right here. We name the process by the companion bone that it touches. So this process right here, of course, is the zygomatic, but the process is touching the temporal bone, so we call this the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. And this process right here, of course, this is the zygomatic bone, but it's touching the frontal bone, so this is the frontal process. And this process right here, okay, that's the maxillary process of the zygomatic bone. So you don't have to memorize everything, you just have to become a little familiar with terminology. All right, so let's use this to give you a little quiz. So here, what bone is this right here? Temporal bone, and here is a process of the temporal bone, and it's touching the zygomatic, so what would be the name of this process of the temporal bone? The zygomatic process of the temporal bone. And in the very early editions of this textbook, there were some that were printed with the names of these processes interchanged. And that was really confusing. Some of the books said that this was the temporal process of the temporal bone. Well, there's no such thing, right? This has got to be the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. And also some books said that this was the zygomatic process of the zygomatic bone. There's no such thing, right? So this process of the zygomatic bone is touching the temporal, so that's the temporal process. All right, so nomenclature is really handy because you don't have to memorize everything in the world. Yeah? No, you cannot.
Like, can you say zygomatic process of the temporal bone?
That's how it has to be.
But then you said temporal process of the zygomatic bone.
The temporal process? Okay, so the zygomatic bone. Well, okay, but we have two different bones, right? We have a temporal bone. I'm not sure if I'm following what you're saying. So you might have it clear in your mind, but let me just say it again. We got two different bones, right? We've got the temporal bone right here and the zygomatic bone. And the processes of the zygomatic bone are never named zygomatic because that's the name of the bone. The processes of the zygomatic bone are named after what companion bone that they are articulating with. So this process of the zygomatic bone is articulating with the temporal. So this process is the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. Okay, and this one here, this is the frontal process of the zygomatic bone, and this one right here is the maxillary process of the zygomatic. All right. Now, what I had mentioned, I did speak incorrectly because I was trying to correct a mistake that's in the book. Some books call this one right here the zygomatic process of the zygomatic bone. It's not labeled correctly because you should know this is really what? The
zygomatic.
It is a zygomatic bone, but what process is this right here? That's the temporal process because it's reaching up and touching the temporal bone. Yeah?
So is
it's never the zygomatic process of the zygomatic bone. Oh, this one right here. Look at this temporal bone right here. All right, so this is the temporal bone, and there's a process that's coming over touching the zygomatic bone. So this right here is the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. Okay?
It's
a description of what connects to what.
Yeah.
Okay? So here is temporal process, here is zygomatic process on either side of that suture right there. And sometimes it's difficult to see that, no matter how I explain it, so I just have to go over it with you after class or something. Okay? And it is even made worse because some textbooks have it mislabeled. So So I really kind of belabor that point. All right. Once you see it, it's going to be really easy to appreciate what's going on there. So don't give up trying to see what how you name these processes. Yeah.
If you look at the code, like if you like an upside down angle, like it is on page 1.
Okay. Yeah, we'll get there.
I know that one of them is pointing at the temporal bone, which is the zygomatic process.
I tell you what. When we get to that picture, ask me. Okay. Okay. I'll show that picture and we can look at it. All right, so let's see, what else do I want to mention about this particular slide? I guess not much, okay, except that the squamous region of the temporal bone, does it say squamous region anywhere? Mm-hmm. You know it should, but what does that mean?
Flat.
That's the flat part of that temporal bone right there, okay, that's the flattest part of it. The temporal bone is interesting because it has another region associated with it. All right, and we're going to look at that region in this particular view. So we've kind of just artificially cut off the top of the skull and removed a couple bones that have been sutured together normally, like the top of the frontal bone and the parietal bones and a little bit of the occipital over here. And in lab, you can take the skull cap off of the skull and look to the inside. And we don't ask you to know what the name of that skull cap is, but it's called a calvarium. All right, so I'm going to use that in lecture. We can remove the calvarium and look inside, and I can see the temporal bone right here. And this region of the temporal bone that's between the internal acoustic meatus and the external acoustic meatus, this is what we call the petrous region of the temporal bone. So the temporal bone's got a couple different regions, the squamous region and the petrous region. And the petrous region is big and thick and bulky because it contains the apparatus for hearing and for equilibrium, maintaining equilibrium when you're walking and changing body position. So there are a lot of structures in there, including those auditory ossicles that I mentioned last time. They're within that petrous region of the temporal bone. Okay. So all right, so I think I'm done talking about that slide. Let's look at, let's just stay on this particular slide right here. All right, so here's a foramen. Foramen, the biggest one, right? Magnum. And it's a passageway for something, namely what? The spinal cord. This is the origin of the spinal cord. So as soon as the brain passes through the occipital bone, it's no longer called the brain, it's called the spinal cord. So that's the threshold for defining what is spinal cord and what is brain. Okay, I'm going to proceed one more slide right here. Now on this slide we see something that's called a fossa. All right, so it's for holding something. What's it holding?
Brain.
The brain. All right, and we see we have an anterior cranial fossa and a middle cranial fossa and a posterior, and you can't appreciate this on a two-dimensional slide, so make sure you see that in lab. You'll see that this sort of looks like one bowl, and there's a little ridge right here, and there's another bowl over here, and then another big, deeper bowl down over here. So the anterior cranial fossa holds the frontal lobes of the brain, and the middle right here holds the temporal lobes of the brain, and the posterior over here holds the occipital lobes as well as cerebellum. And you're not really familiar with those objects yet, but those are just something to look forward to. Okay, so these fossa are holding different parts of the brain. But you can also see some other holes besides the foramen magnum. And of course, in lab, you got to be familiar with these things. All right, and this right here is the most superior aspect of the ethmoid bone. And this is just superior to your nasal cavity. And so in order for you to smell things, there have to be nerves that go from your brain into your nasal cavity so that you have the sense of smell. And so this part of the ethmoid bone that is flat, that's helping make the anterior fossa right here, anterior cranial fossa, do you see all those little holes right there? So what the plural of a foramen is what? Foramina. So these are the olfactory foramina. See if the door's locked. Good, it's not. All right, and all those foramina, there are passageways for olfactory nerves that are going into your nasal cavity. And that's sort of an interesting area because that's the only place in your body where you actually have nervous tissue dangling out in the outside world, just into the atmosphere. You don't have nerves hanging out of your body anywhere else except in your nose. So those get beat up all the time, right? Because they're not protected by the surroundings of your body. And the other interesting thing about those nerves is because they're out in space, just dangling inside your nose, they don't live very long. And what is your impression about nerves, generally speaking? Do they have a tendency to regenerate themselves, or do you think that's a difficult tissue to regenerate?
Very difficult.
Very difficult. But here is an exception to that rule. So these nerve cells regenerate themselves all the time.
Just the olfactory nerves.
The olfactory nerves.
Okay.
So since nature has figured out a way to do it, no doubt humankind will figure out a way how to do it once we figure out how those nasal or the olfactory nerves regenerate themselves. So that'd be really cool to learn how they do it and then teach spinal cord neurons how to regenerate themselves, and we could heal spinal cord injuries. Okay, so anatomy is pretty cool, right, in terms of applications to medicine. All right, and the plate of the ethmoid bone that all those olfactory foramina are in is called the cribriform plate, which you can see on this slide. Okay, the cribriform plate. What you can't see very well on this slide, a part of the ethmoid bone, is what we call the crista galli. Let me just change views. Can I change views? I can't hardly see. I can't really see. Oh, yeah. Okay, so the ethmoid bone helps make up the nasal cavity, right? And so here is the floor of the anterior cranial fossa, and here's that crista galli, kind of looks like a little shark's fin sticking up. That's also very important because it attaches to the membranes that surround the brain, which we call the meninges. So that anchors the meninges, which is holding your brain in place, to your skull. So the ethmoid bone looks kind of strange in lab, but it's very important because it does what? It helps glue your brain to your skull so it doesn't slosh around in there very much. Right? So that's the job of the crista galli. All right. Well, I was talking about foramina on the inside of the skull. So these are the olfactory foramina are the most anterior. The next one is the optic canal. All right. And then the next one, we're going to just trace these down in order. All right. So then the optic canal, then we have the foramen rotundum, foramen ovale. How about if I zoom in? Okay. Can you see that a little bit better? So olfactory foramina, optic canal, foramen rotundum, foramen ovale. What do they call that ovale? Because it's oval. Foramen spinosum, because it's really, really small. It's just like a needle point going through there. And then we're now by the petrous region of the temporal bone. That's kind of a ridge going through the base of the cranium. So if you go over this hill, you come down into this valley right over here, and what do we find usually in a valley someplace? A lake, right? So I think we call this foramen lacerum, okay? Lacerum. Don't say lucerum, okay? Okay, lacerum. All right, so foramen lacerum. So that covers most of these pretty well. Then we have the internal acoustic meatus. Hopefully that's labeled over here. All right, and so now this is the petrous region. What's on the opposite side of this petrous region that's on the exterior of the skull? You have the external auditory meatus. External auditory meatus. They line up, but it's not patent. You can't go from one to the other because in this region you have all of that apparatus for hearing and for equilibrium. All right, then you got the jugular foramen, hypoglossal canal, and foramen magnum. So if you're going to have difficulty in lab remembering that, all right, just draw it out. Probably if you just draw that out about five times, right, then it's going to be pretty easy to remember how to recognize those different foramina. All right. Should we do that real quick? How do you practice labeling these things? Let's see if I can remember. All right. So what do we got right here? Got a marker that isn't drawing really dark. Let's try. All right, let's try this one here. Oh, that's better. All right, so what are all of these in the most anterior? Yeah, olfactory, Olfactory foramina, and I'm just going to abbreviate F, right, for foramina. Olfactory foramina, what's the next one? About maybe about that location right there.
Optic canal.
Yeah. Optic canal. All right, and then we've got one that's maybe like right about here. Okay, and then we got one that's kind of like right about there. And then we got one about right there. Okay, so I'll try to mark these. This is what? Rotundum and ovale and then spinosum. All right, and then there's like this ridge right here, and then you go down into the valley. We got lacerum. Okay, we're doing pretty good. We're running out of bone here, but I think we'll be able to squeeze it in. All right, so after lacerum, what do we got? We've got the, yeah, we got the internal acoustic or auditory meatus. All right, and then a bigger one, jugular foramen, and then a little tiny one over here, and then a bigger one. Okay, so hypoglossal, and then foramen magnum. All right, so copy that down, practice it. Probably if you do it 5 times, you'll know that. So it looks really intimidating to students when they first see all those foramen right there, all those foramina, but it's not bad. Okay, it's not too bad. Okay, the other interesting thing we see in the base of the skull, of course, is this sphenoid bone that moves all the way or courses from right to left side. It's very important because there is a depression right here, a fossa. It's so important that we don't even call it a fossa. But it is a fossa. It's holding something. Does anybody know what it's holding?
The pituitary
gland, very important endocrine gland. It's like a master endocrine gland in our body. So the pituitary sits right in here. So this is the cella turcica or turcica cella. Okay. This is not an exam figure, and in lab I don't think you have to memorize all these different processes, but be sure to refer to your lab list, okay, to make sure which parts of all these different bones you do have to know. Okay, I'm sure you have to know all those different fossa and probably what bone they belong to as well. Okay. All right, let me go back to my list right up over here. Okay. We're doing pretty good. All right, so here is a disarticulated what kind of bone? Temporal bone. Right, so here is the zygomatic process. Now, here's a good check. And I would like to ask some people over here that had questions. How would you name this process of the temporal bone and why? That's the zygomatic process. Why would you call that the zygomatic process? Because what bone is it articulating with? The zygomatic bone. Right, so again, it's just nomenclature. Don't have to memorize it. Don't have to memorize that. So the zygomatic bone, which is what? Our cheekbone, which would be right about here. Okay, mastoid process, styloid process, the squamous region, and you should probably be able to say what kind of suture that is right there, the name of that suture. Yeah, the squamous suture, right? And the occipital mastoid suture, right? Okay. Let me go back to, that's a pretty good one, but this is even better right here. All right, so this forms an arch. The zygomatic process of the temporal bone forms an arch with the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. And so if we put these two processes together, it forms like a bridge or an arch, and you should know what that's called as well. And that's called the, what is that called? That's the zygomatic arch. That's the zygomatic arch. That you have to memorize. I don't have a good way to tell you. Okay, so we got the cranial bones, facial bones. Some cranial bones and some facial bones have big cavities inside of them. And they're called paranasal sinuses. And I see one, two, in this particular slide. This is sort of like a sagittal section. Okay, and here is the frontal bone, and here's a big space inside the frontal bone. That's the frontal And that's actually what we call to be really specific, that's called the paranasal sinus. All right, so it is a sinus, a nasal sinus, but we just say paranasal because it's associated with a nasal cavity. And that's filled with lymphatic tissue. Maybe I mentioned that last time, I forgot, right? Okay, that helps fight infection. This is the sphenoid bone, and it's as it's moving from right to left across your anterior, middle cranial fossa right here. And here are the sphenoid sinuses. So be sure to look these up in lab and find them. Okay, we also have a sinus in this bone here, which we don't see right at the moment because we're too medial. But if you go laterally, you would see the maxilla has a paranasal sinus as well. And also, we can't see it because this is a sagittal section in the ethmoid bone. The ethmoid bone has paranasal sinuses as well. And all of these things fight infection. So that's another reason why I like the ethmoid bone a lot. Okay? So it's got foramina so you can smell. It's got the crista galli so your brain doesn't slosh around inside your head. It's got sinuses to help fight infection. It has this perpendicular plate that helps make up the nasal septum so that you can breathe. So that ethmoid bone is really important. It's doing all those different kinds of things. All right, so try to pay attention to more than just the structure, but to get an appreciation for what this thing is doing in there. Yeah.
Isn't the crista galli dangerous?
Well, you know that cribriform plate. What does a cribriform plate have? All those olfactory foramina. And when you have a bone that's relatively thin and you put all those holes in it, guess how strong it is? It's not super strong, right? So if someone has a facial traumatic insult, right, it is easy to break that cribriform plate, right? And depending on the kind of trauma, right, it can push that crista galli up into the brain, okay, which of course is terrible. And also, you can have brain pushing the cribriform plate out, and you can have brain going into the nose. So if there is severe trauma to the head, that's an area that can be damaged pretty easily. So yeah, your impression is correct about that.
Bleeding and swelling.
Yeah, if you're lucky enough to live through that initial incident, then that's something to consider. But obviously, if somebody has brain coming into their nasal cavity, the prognosis is extremely poor, right?
Considering the crista galli is like pretty much thin.
Yeah.
Is it also possible, if there was a kind of head injury, it could possibly break?
It usually doesn't break too much because the brain is very soft. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if something's going to break, it's going to be the nerves in that area of the brain are going to be lacerated. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, yeah. So, for instance, when you're out riding your bicycle, what should you do?
Wear a helmet.
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly right. And a motorcycle, for sure. Don't ever consider that. Yeah.
You mentioned
yeah. We got four.
Okay.
Okay.
All of them contain
lymphatic tissue.
All of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they all do. And they all open to the nasal cavity through their own particular foramen. We don't show you where those are in this textbook or have you name them, but they are open to your nasal cavity. So they can become infected, they can drain, they can fill up with fluid, and when they are infected or fill up with fluid, you'll feel a pressure, and that can trigger, for instance, a headache or migraine, for instance, something like that.
So the ethmoid is the only one not?
The ethmoid is open to the nasal cavity as well.
Which one is it?
Ethmoid? I don't see it here.
No, which one is not?
They all are. They all are.
Okay.
Yeah, no, they all are. Sorry. I must. Yeah, they all are open to the nasal cavity. So the other thing that you see on this slide that is sort of interesting is that we see the roof of the mouth. And how do we consider the roof of the mouth? Well, there's a hard palate that's made of bone, and then there's a soft palate that's made of soft tissue. And of course, on this picture, we only see what? Bone, or the hard palate. And so the hard palate anteriorly is made out of the maxilla, right? Palatine processes of the maxilla, and here is the palatine bone, which makes up the posterior roof of the mouth as well as the lateral walls of the nasal cavity. So this is what we would call the horizontal plate of the palatine bone. So that leads us right up to the nasal cavity, and in particular the nasal septum. And we see that there are two bones that make up the nasal septum. The inferior bone is what we call the vomer, and the superior bone is actually part of the ethmoid. So again, another function of the ethmoid is that it allows us to breathe because it guides air into our respiratory passageways. Okay, so this is what we call the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone. And somebody in lab the other day asked me, well, how come we have such a big nose sticking out of our face? I don't see any bones right here. So that is cartilage, yeah, the nasal cartilages. And in lecture, I don't ask you to know the names of the cartilages, but when you're looking at a skull in lab, you don't see any cartilage on them at all, right? Because it's soft tissue, it would rot off and be nasty to look at. Okay, so that's why you don't see like a regular nose. But I think in your textbook, you do have a pretty nice picture of the nasal cartilages. All right, so you should be able to identify this bone really quick. Looks like a butterfly or a bat. That's a sphenoid with the cella turcica right here, the greater wing and lesser wing, optic canal in it. It also has a foramen ovale and that little foramen spinosum right here. Okay, so sphenoid bone. Here's a little bit different view of it. This is the body of the sphenoid bone. Okay. Ah, here is the ethmoid bone. And you can see the plate that makes up the nasal septum right here. That's the perpendicular plate. There's the crista galli, the cribriform plate with all the olfactory foramina. Can you see any in there? There's a couple. All right. And then, of course, all these holes are what? The paranasal sinuses that help fight infection. Okay. Say that again. Sure. All the sinuses, even the frontal sinus and maxillary sinus, and even sphenoid sinus. And you could probably even get an infection in one on one side and not the other, and you'll feel that pressure in just one side. Yeah, some people might have one that's chronically infected, okay, and they'll feel that pressure.
Is that kind of like, it, with the whole pressure on either side, though, does that kind of explain, like, why there's one side affects all stuff and the other side not?
Yeah, because one is infected and the other is not, okay? Exactly right. All right, so here's the only bone that moves, right? Be familiar with the coronoid process that doesn't form the TMJ. What forms the TMJ? The mandibular condyle, right here. Okay, well, you can see it on the diagram. So here is the ramus, here's the angle, here's the body of the mandible, mental foramen, and here is the mandibular foramen in the medial aspect of the mandibular ramus. So don't confuse mandibular foramen with the mental foramen. That would be pretty easy to do, I would guess. Okay. So these holes in the bone that the teeth fit in, okay, that's a depression for holding something. And what was I going to talk? I was going to say something about that. Oh, yes. Okay, so here is the alveolar margin. These holes are alveoli. And can you see, let me really zoom in. All right, can you see this little point right here that's sticking up between the teeth, between the alveoli? All right, so that's a process. What's the function of a process? Muscle attachment. All right, but do you see any muscles right here?
No.
Okay, so here is an exception. It's not that I lied to you, but here is an exception to the rule. A process usually has a muscle attached to it, but the mandible is going to be stressed because there is dense regular connective tissue that holds the teeth into the alveoli. So it's not a muscle attachment, but it's an attachment for a ligament. So there are ligaments that go from the mandible to a tooth that hold the tooth in position, and that's what builds up the lower jawbone and gives you the facial features that you have. All right, so in this particular case, these alveolar processes don't attach a muscle, they attach a ligament, and a ligament is what? A bone-to-bone connection. So it's just a little variation of what I describe what the function of a process is. Here's an exception to that rule. All right, so we said that exercise builds bone up. What happens if somebody loses all their teeth? What happens to their mandible? It shrinks. It dissolves away because it's not being stressed, and people, especially the elderly, their jawbone has a tendency to regress and shrink because they don't have all their teeth in them, right? If they're wearing dentures, that doesn't stress the mandible as much as normal. Okay. All right, so that's mandible. Maxilla, okay? In this region of the maxilla would be the paranasal sinuses. Here's the anterior nasal spine that you can see in lab pretty easily. And here is how, now why do we call it the frontal process? Because what is it articulating with? The frontal bone, right? So it's really good to be able to look at these articulated bones and see how they fit inside the skull. Okay. All right, so this is a facial bone, the upper jawbone. Yeah. 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 Yeah, they would use dentures. There are different ways to treat that, and I'm not really up on clinical dentistry very much, but I think the latest technique is actually to put in a screw into the jaw, one for each tooth that you want to place, and that's called a dental implant. And the bone will start to grow around it and adhere to that screw, and on top of that screw, they can build a prosthesis or a prosthetic tooth and glue it to the screw that's in the jaw, and then it performs pretty much like a normal tooth, and that screw, when you chew, right, bends and squishes the mandible, and that maintains the health and of the mandible. That keeps the mandible looking the way it should, and it keeps the occlusion proper in your face, so that when you chew, the teeth come together. Occlusion is how the teeth come together. Okay, so dentures are one way to handle that, or with an implant would be another way, and if someone works in a dental office, they could probably figure out or know some other ways that that can be done as well. There are what? There are bridges and things? I don't know if for sure. A bridge is just placing a tooth right here, but it's actually connected by metal to neighboring teeth that hold it in position. And that probably does not maintain the health of the mandible. Okay? It probably just wears the teeth down that are holding the middle one in place. Yeah.
How
does the teeth start falling out the first place? Like, oh, well, yeah, age, but what is the underlying factor right here? And that is because there is a lot of soft tissue that surrounds the tooth as it's coming out of the mandible, and those are, sometimes we might want to call those pockets, but pocket is really a clinical definition for an exaggeration of that space that is chronically infected. So infections cause that process for you to lose that tooth. All right, so that would, we would call that periodontal disease or gum disease. That's what's going to cause somebody to lose their teeth. Of course, there's other things like maybe trauma and things like that. So proper dental hygiene, it is possible to live your whole life with all of your teeth, right, if you take care of them. How do you take care of them? It's terrible. It's like diet and exercise, right? You got to brush your teeth, you got to floss, right, and all that kind of stuff. But I would suppose if somebody would start doing that at an early age when your teeth are perfect and it's hard to appreciate how important it is to keep good hygiene in your mouth, then you probably won't lose your teeth. Okay, so that's my understanding. But there might be other, some other kinds of pathophysiology where people will lose their teeth, besides trauma, for instance. Yeah, yeah. There's another question? Yeah. Oh, the deciduous teeth, the teeth that pop out, they're smaller. The root is a lot smaller. I don't know, I don't have a feel for how much smaller it is. I don't know if it's 50% smaller. But yeah, you can see that these roots extend way down into the mandible. Absolutely, yeah. I would say that for the amount of tooth that's poking up, probably two-thirds of it is actually poking, inserted into the alveoli of the mandible, ballpark. Talk to your dentist about that and say, oh, my professor, anatomy professor said. How close was he? Okay, probably fairly close. Okay. But if it's been a really long time since your dentist has taken an anatomy class, maybe they don't know anymore. Okay, because it's easy. Yeah, it's easy to forget stuff if you don't use it. All right, so here is, what do we have right here? There are some plates inside the nasal cavity, which we call these conchae. These are horizontal plates. And These are filled with mucous membranes, not really so much lymphatic tissue, but mucous membranes. These humidify the air as you breathe in so you don't desiccate your lungs. And if the air is hot, they'd help cool the air down. Or if the air is cold, it helps warm the air up so that the air is conditioned by the time it gets into your lungs. Yeah. Okay. A powder?
It's like bone.
Maybe powdered bone, granular bone. You know, I'm not for, like, for reconstructing somebody's dentition, doing a bone graft, because sometimes bones are too thin to place a tooth or a prosthesis or something. Beyond my level of understanding, I just don't know what the powder is. I don't know if it's calcium phosphate, like a regular bone, or if it's... It's artificial bone. Yeah, but I don't know what it's made out of. So, I really don't know. Have to do a Google on that. Okay. What else do I see? Well, next to this palatine process, why do we call this the palatine process of the maxilla? Because it is articulating with the palatine bone. Right? So, again, nomenclature. You don't have to memorize everything. It's really important to just know nomenclature. Here is a foramen in this anterior part, anterior margin of the palatine process of the maxilla bone. Does anybody know what that's called? I think that's on your lab list. That's the incisive foramen. Incisive foramen, because these teeth right here are incisors. These are incisors. Okay, as opposed to canines and molars over here. I was talking about nasal concha. These are the shelves inside your nasal cavity, and the inferior nasal, there are three, inferior nasal concha, middle nasal concha, superior nasal concha. The inferior nasal concha is a bone all by itself. Doesn't belong to the palatine, doesn't belong to ethmoid, doesn't belong to the maxilla. It's just a freestanding bone that is articulating to the ethmoid, but it's not really part of the ethmoid. All right, the middle and superior are actually part of the ethmoid bone. They're just processes. Ooh, another exception to that rule. These are processes sticking off the ethmoid bone. But again, if it's a process, right, here are these two processes, but they don't attach to muscles. So that's another exception to that rule. But most of the time when you say the function of a process is what? Muscle attachment. You're going to be right. Okay. Except for what? Those alveolar processes that hold a ligament, that hold your teeth in position. Okay. And then these processes help humidify the air. Now you can see a nice nasal cartilage right here as it attaches to the, what is this right here? The vomer. And this is the ethmoid. You got a nice cribriform, nice crista galli. There's that cribriform plate right here. And clinically, what's relevant here and also important, here is the cella turcica in the sphenoid bone, and here is the roof of the posterior roof of the nasal cavity right here. So a lot of times people can come down with tumors of the pituitary gland, and it's very deep inside your brain, except if you look at this particular image, you can see how easy it is to get to the pituitary gland. How would you get to the pituitary gland? Like move all the way through somebody's brain from the front or from the side or whatever? That would be really difficult. Just go right through, right, the nose or oral cavity, right up to the base of the body of the sphenoid bone, go through the sphenoid sinus, and you're right there at the cella turcica. So as far as brain surgery is concerned, it's relatively easy, right, because we don't have to cross any major cranial bones. Okay. So anatomy is fun because you can see the relationship between all these various structures. All right, here we can see the paranasal sinuses, the four paranasal sinuses. Okay, there's a hyoid bone. And, okay, so I think I'm done talking about the head, unless I remember something else to say about it. All right, let's talk about the vertebral column. Is that part, what part of the skeleton is that?
Spinal cord.
That's the spinal cord. Actually, when you think of spinal cord, maybe you should think of nervous tissue, neurons in the spinal cord, okay? If I was going to say something, maybe I would say vertebral column. Okay, so spinal cord and vertebral column are really two different kinds of things. But what part of the skeleton is the vertebral column? It's axial, right? It's part of the axial skeleton. All right, and there are a number of different divisions of, so here is the vertebral column. It's made up of vertebrae. It's also made up of the sacrum, and the sacrum are just a number of vertebrae that have fused together. So again, the sacrum is what? Vertebrae fused together. And the coccyx, again, are vertebrae that have fused together. So the whole vertebral column is made up of vertebrae. So the different divisions, the division that's holding your head up is what we call the cervical region that makes up the neck, right? The next inferior division is the thoracic division, and that forms the thoracic cage. Attached to each of these thoracic vertebrae is another bone, which actually helps define that these are thoracic vertebrae. What bone attaches to a thoracic vertebrae and actually no other vertebrae? Ribs. That's right. So if a vertebrae has a rib attached to it, it's got to be, by definition, what kind of vertebrae? A thoracic vertebrae, right? A thoracic vertebrae. Right, and then lumbar, right here, don't have ribs attached to them. They're inferior to the thoracic region, and then even inferior to the lumbar is the sacrum and the coccyx. All right, so you have 7 cervical vertebrae. You got 12 thoracic. So if you got 12 thoracic vertebrae, how many ribs do you have?
12.
You got 12, yeah, pairs. You got 12 pairs. If you said 24, that's fine. All right, so 12 pairs or 24. By definition, there's got to be a one-to-one correspondence, and not everybody in this room might have 12 vertebrae. Somebody might have 11. Somebody might have 13. What do we call that? That's just what we call anatomic variation. That's not really an abnormal condition. Anatomic variation are the somewhat major differences between people. It's not very common, but it can happen without causing problems. There's a line of horses that they all are missing one vertebrae, okay? So, and I forget how many vertebrae horses have in that particular region, but they're missing one vertebrae, so they're a little bit shorter and stockier, which means that they're really strong as a result of that. What kind of horse is missing one vertebrae? Anybody know? Is there an equestrian in here? Arabian. Yeah. So they're stronger horses because they're missing that one vertebrae, and they're bred so that they never lose that vertebrae. Okay, and then lumbar is 5. You got 5 lumbar. Okay, you got usually about 5 fused vertebrae in the sacrum. There might be sometimes, again, more or less. And the coccyx is highly variable, from 3 to 5. It all depends on the person. So again, what do you call that variation? That's called anatomic variation. Yeah.
When they put epidural, right?
Yeah. When I get to a picture, I don't think we get to it in the skeletal system. When we get to the nervous system, that's when I'll point that out to you. But if you're really interested, maybe after class I can show you. I just don't have it to show you, a good picture to show you right now, okay? Because we only got bones here and not the membranes or the spinal cord to show you, okay? But it will make really good sense when you see it. All right, so how are you going to remember? 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, 5 lumbar. Some of you maybe will be like me and just don't like to memorize anything. I'd like to actually have an understanding of something or figure a trick so I don't actually have to waste a lot of my brain just trying to remember numbers like that. So how can you do that? Because that could be a question on a test. Could be referring to time. Yeah, use a good time model. That's what I do. Okay, so breakfast you have at 7 a.m. and you have lunch at 12. Which reminds me, okay, we got a half hour, and then supper at 5, right? So 7, 12, and 5. If you have photographic memory, all you have to do is look at that picture and you automatically know. So I don't have that kind of memory. All right, so don't forget about anatomic variation in the vertebral column. So if we look at this vertebral column with an anterior view, it looks what? Really nice and straight. That's not really true, and I don't have a good view of it. Does it look perfectly straight, or is there a little bend in it?
Yeah, it's
Hey, you know, that looks pretty straight, but there really is a little bit of a bend in it, right in your thoracic region, because you got a real important organ that's sort of right smack in the middle. Or you have your heart right there, so your vertebral column does actually have to bend over to the right a little bit so that it can move around the heart. All right, so we don't see that on this diagram. But if we look at a lateral view of the spinal cord, we do see some curvatures right here. Okay, and again, the function of these curvatures is like the that one little lateral bend that I talked about moving around the heart, because, for instance, this thoracic curvature right here is making room for the lungs and the heart, right? And this pelvic curvature right here is making room for pelvic organs, okay? So that's what those curvatures are for. And then there's another one here. This is a cervical curvature and lumbar curvature. These are anterior curvatures, right? The lumbar and cervical. And these just help position weight over the center of gravity in your body so you don't have to use so much muscle standing erect. Okay, so these curvatures, the cervical and lumbar, is to maintain balance. The thoracic and pelvic curvatures are there to accommodate organs that are in those cavities. That's why those curvatures are there. So a lateral curvature of the spine should really never occur. Does anybody know what that's called? If there is one? That's scoliosis, right? So there's a little minor curvature for the heart, but that's about it. Okay. Let me go back to the list right here. Oh, yeah, here are the different kinds of curvatures. Okay. Let's look at a general vertebrae. So general vertebrae has the body or the centrum. This is the major weight-bearing part of a vertebrae. All right, and then there's a spiny process that comes posterior from the body. That's a pedicle. And then there's another bony ridge that's called a lamina. And if we put a pedicle and a lamina together, that forms a vertebral arch. So all vertebrae have that vertebral arch. Projecting straight posterior is the spinous process that you can palpate with your fingertips. And there are some lateral processes as well. These we call the transverse processes. So what's the function of this spinous process right here? Ooh, you would want to say muscle attachment. Okay, what's the function of this transverse process?
Muscle attachment.
Yeah, it's just muscle attachment. Okay. And then there are some articulations. So here's an articular surface. This is going to articulate with the vertebrae either above it or below it. And there's going to be an intervertebral disc, which is a very strong kind of cartilage. Anybody remember what kind of fibrocartilage? Right? So there's going to be an intervertebral disc, which part of it is fibrocartilage. What else do we have? Oh, here's the hole that the spinal cord goes through. We call that the vertebral foramen, and there are some other processes that help align the joints between vertebrae. So this would be a superior articulating process, and the smooth indentation right here is part of the joint, so we call that a facet. It usually would have cartilage in there, and you should palpate that with your fingertip, okay, because it should be nice and smooth, and you should be able to identify that. There are a couple other little small dimples on this particular vertebrae which are going to be smooth. There is one over here, and there is one over here. Now, not all vertebrae have this facet, and we call this a little demi-facet right here. We only find these on thoracic vertebrae. So what are these facets articulating with? If you see these only on thoracic vertebrae. The ribs, that's right. So the head of a rib is going to articulate here, and the tubercle of the rib is going to articulate here. And so a rib is going to move posteriorly before it goes laterally and then courses anteriorly to form your thoracic cage. All right, so this is probably a pretty good object for you to draw out as well. Make sure you can draw all the different parts of this vertebrae right here. Okay? Know what the pedicle is and the lamina and the processes, for instance. Okay. Most vertebrae do not have a particular name associated with them. So let me just go back. Except for two. Most vertebrae are just given a number by first what division they're in, and then by what location they are, starting with the superior one is given the number one. So typically we have the very last vertebrae in the thoracic region is called thoracic 12, but commonly that's just called T12, right? And in the cervical region you have this one right here, C7, which stands for cervical, all right? And then sacral is down over here, but here's a little confusion. Here we have some coccygeal vertebrae. Do we want to call those C? Would this be like C1, C2? You can't do that because that would conflict with cervical. So these are abbreviated capital C, little O. Okay, but there's usually no clinical significance of these little vestigial tail vertebrae right here. So nomenclature isn't too important. But if you see a CO, that would stand for coccygeal vertebrae. All right, now the only two that have names are the first two, the first superior two of in the cervical region. They do have names. And the one that is articulating with the occipital bone is named after that mythological figure, at least in my system of believing, right, is Atlas, right, the god that's holding up the world. Probably you've seen a statue or a paint, probably statue of Atlas. And so that's why they named that the Atlas, because the atlas is holding up your head. All right, so let's take a look quickly at... I'll go back and talk about that intervertebral disc in just a second. So, here is the atlas, and it is noteworthy because it's missing something. What is it missing compared to the previous slide? It's missing the body, the vertebral body in particular. I don't see a vertebral body right here. I see a transverse process here, and I actually see a little bit of a spinous process, but we call that the posterior tubercle. The tubercle is a process, so what's the function of this tubercle? Muscle attachment. Here's the anterior tubercle, that's for muscle attachment. All right, and the spinal cord in this region is very big, so the vertebral foramen is large. Here's an articulating surface or facet for articulating with the occipital bone. And I think that's good for now. So the atlas is easy to see because it's missing the body. It had a body at one time, but where did it go? It moved. This is probably just an inferior view of the atlas. The body of C1, or the body of the atlas, ends up being fused to the body of C2. So you see this little projection right here? That's really what was the body of C1, but it's attached to C2. And this is going to have some important implications for the articulation between C1 and C2. We call this the odontoid process, or the dens. It's got two names. And probably in lab, if this is a practicum question, you can use either one of those. People usually put down dens because they don't want a mistake in spelling odontoid process. But odontoid is pretty easy to spell exactly the way it's pronounced. And why is it important to know spelling for lab practicums? Because it's school. That's right. That's my answer. You have to know spelling in this class because this is school. So just you can use dens. All right. So here's the body. Here is a nice spinous process. And it shows a nice characteristic that only cervical vertebrae have. And that is that the spinous process is bifurcated. You see two points over here instead of one. If you ever see a vertebrae that's got two points, you know automatically that it is a cervical vertebrae. If it's just one sharp point, it could be a lumbar, could be a thoracic, and not a cervical vertebrae. Okay. There is another important landmark that you should know that distinguishes a cervical vertebrae from any other kind of vertebrae, and that is the within the transverse processes, there are holes. So we call those transverse foramina, one on the right and one on the left. Right? And that's another nice clue that it is a cervical vertebrae. So if you see a vertebrae with the transverse foramina, you know it's cervical. Okay, I was going to ask you, what's the name of that? What's the function of that foramen right there? The transverse frame, it's a passageway. That's right. There are blood vessels that go through there that are coursing up to your brain. And those blood vessels go through the vertebrae. So the name of that blood vessel or these blood vessels are the vertebrals, vertebral artery, vertebral vein. You might think that they're called the transverse arteries, but they're not. Vertebral arteries. Yeah.
Isn't there some foramen that's used for the nerves?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Foramen can have arteries, veins, nerves, even muscles going through them, depending on where they are in the body. Okay. Like, where is a foramen that has nerves going through it? I see it on this slide right here. What is it called? The vertebral foramen. Yeah, what's going through there? Millions of nerves. The spinal cord is going through there. Foramen magnum has nerves going through it. Yeah, so there are many, many foramina that have nerves going through them. Okay, so C3 doesn't have a specific name. C4 doesn't. C7 sort of has a name because if you feel the back of your neck, can you feel the back of your neck and start up by your occipital bone and kind of slide down, you run into a bump. You all kind of have a little hump right there. Yeah. You feel that little hump right there? That's called the cervical prominence. It's a prominent bump, and that's due to C7 kind of poking out right there. That's the cervical prominence. Okay. All right, so what vertebrae has a bends? C2. Yeah, C2. Not all cervical, only C2. Okay, so the joint between C1, which I see right here, and C2, notice that there is a nice transverse ligament that's attaching between the lateral parts of C1 that approximate, come very close to the dens right here that hold C1 and C2 together. And this joint between C1 and C2 allows for rotation. Now, we haven't defined motions in here, but rotation is this kind of motion. What do you call this motion? It's my least favorite answer. That is what?
Rotation.
This is the no. Yeah, this is the right. This is what the no answer. That's why I said it's like my least favorite answer. We call that rotation. All right, so you can rotate your neck between C1 and C2. That's the motion that's allowed. Okay, but what is another motion that you can perform with your neck, which is my favorite answer?
Yes,
that's this. This is called flexion and extension. Flexion and extension. That motion is not allowed between C1 and C2. And if the joint between C1 and C2 is flexed, maybe due to some kind of trauma, that's going to break C1. That might break off the dens, right? Which is what kind of injury?
Cervical spine injury.
Well, that's very traumatic, right? It could be fatal. It could be immediately fatal, right? If the dens breaks off and goes into the spinal cord, then that's it immediately. You can have many stable fractures of C1 if people are transported to the hospital correctly. So if you ever see any kind of traumatic injury happening on the freeway or something, what's the most important thing? Yeah, never move somebody, right? Never move their head, never move their body, because there might be a stable fracture of C1, and when you move them, that fracture, right, gets worse, and it lacerates the spinal cord, and then they'll be paralyzed from the neck down for the rest of their life. So never move anybody. Okay, let trained professionals move people. All right, so now where can you flex and extend? You can't do it between C1 and C2 because that's only rotation. Where can you flex and extend? Yes, motion. That is allowed between the occipital bone and C1, this joint right here. So flexion and extension is between occipital bone and C1. Rotation is between C1 and C2. And again, if you rotate between the occipital bone and C1, that joint is not designed to do that, something's going to break. All right, so, and again, that's really pretty bad. So here is the cervical prominence right here, or the vertebral prominence at C7, because the spinous process is very prominent and sticking out. Okay. All right, there is a foramen. Well, I tell you what, let me go back to here. So here's the vertebral foramen. There is another foramen that we see in the spinal column or vertebral column that you can't see on an individual vertebrae. You actually have to put a couple vertebrae together to see it. So when you put them together, this hole magically appears. And it's the way that nerves can leave the vertebral column. And I see it right here. Is that it right there? I guess that's it right there. Is it tucked away in here someplace? This is a better view. Right here. So if we have a superior and an inferior vertebrae, put them together, this forms the intervertebral foramen. So intervertebral is different than the vertebral foramen. Vertebral is for the spinal cord. The intervertebral is a way for spinal nerves to actually go to distant parts of your body. All right, so that's intervertebral foramen right here. All right, and then we have the sacrum and the coccyx. And these foramina right here have different names depending on what side of the sacrum you're looking at. If you're looking at the anterior side, like what we have right over here, these are what we call the anterior sacral foramina. But if we're looking from the posterior side over here, what do we call them? Posterior sacral foramen. But they're really what? The same? They're really the same hole. But functionally they're different because there are nerves that leave the vertebral column anteriorly. They come out this way, and then there are some nerves that exit posteriorly. So depending on how you look at that particular foramen, it's got a different name because it has a different function because different nerves are going through them. Okay. Okay. The body of the sacrum. This big space right here is what we call the sacral canal. This hole down here at the bottom is the sacral hiatus, so the sacral canal goes all the way through the sacrum. And so here is the median sacral crest. What's the function of this median sacral crest right here? It's a process, so it is muscle attachment. Yep, muscle attachment. Okay. All right, then the thoracic cage. I think we're almost done. Before I get to the thoracic cage, let me go back. Let's talk about intervertebral discs just for a second. Okay. I don't have a normal one. Here's an abnormal one. And this is the spinal cord inside the vertebral canal. Underneath this object right here is going to be the body of a vertebrae. And in between bodies of vertebrae is an intervertebral disc. Part of it is made out of fibrocartilage. And this external ring right here, which in a healthy disc should be continuous, right, that's what we call the annulus fibrosus. That's fibrocartilage. But the deep or the medulla of a disc is what we call the nucleus pulposus. And that's a jelly-like compound. That's not fibrocartilage. And so when the intervertebral discs, for instance, instead of just holding weight on top of them, if they're twisted, all right, or if there's some kind of torsion within the spinal cord, okay, that can compress the nucleus pulposus and damage the annulus fibrosus, and the nucleus pulposus can actually squirt out and deform the fibrosus right here, and it has a tendency, or can have a tendency, to squirt out into the, what's the name of this foramen right here? That's the intervertebral foramen, and there are nerves that are going through that foramen, and when the pulposus pushes on those nerves, it causes a nerve block, and that can be a motor deficit, which means you can't control that part of your body, or it could be a sensory type of lesion, so it's going to give you inappropriate sensation in that part of the body, or it could be both. Okay, so that's parts of the intervertebral disc. All right, let's talk about the thoracic cage. Thoracic cage posteriorly is made up of the vertebrae, but laterally and anteriorly it's made up of ribs. How many ribs do you have? You got 12 because that's how many thoracic vertebrae you have. The most anterior part of the thoracic cage is the sternum, and the sternum has got three parts to it. There's the body, which is the major part, and the most inferior part is the xiphoid process, and the superior part over here is the manubrium, and here's the sternal angle between the manubrium and the body of the sternum. And clinically, this is probably pretty important, even for the layperson, the xiphoid process, because you can see it's pretty short and dainty, and it can break off of the body of the sternum quite easily. So if somebody knows CPR, they're always taught to do what with this xiphoid process? Stay away from it, right? So if somebody's heart isn't beating and you want to do chest compressions on somebody, basically you're beating their heart for them so that it can pump some blood to their brain. How long can the brain stay alive without oxygen? Did we ever talk about that in this class? Once upon a time? Okay, when your heart stops, your brain loses consciousness in 3 seconds, because that's how much oxygen it needs to make ATP. And then, after what period of time does your brain die?
3 minutes.
Yeah, the range is correct. It's different for everybody, but I just say 3 and 3. 3 seconds, 3 minutes. So chest compressions will save somebody's brain until they get their heart started again, but you don't want to push on the xiphoid process right here, because it will break off, and there's some deeper organs that will be lacerated, so then you have a patient whose heart isn't beating and also bleeding in the liver.
Yeah.
All right, so you're not helping out very much. So stay away from the xiphoid process right here. Okay. Notice that the ribs attach to the sternum, or at least some of them do, by these costal cartilages. The first 7 attach directly to the sternum, either the manubrium, right, the sternal angle right here, or the body of the sternum. So since they attach directly to the sternum, we call these true ribs. Right, the next 5 we call false ribs, because they don't attach directly to the sternum. Here I see a false rib. It has cartilage, and it attaches how? Indirectly. It attaches to the costal cartilage, to a superior rib, which then attaches to the manubrium. So you're going to have to find a good diagram or look on a skeleton to see that, or you can just kind of memorize it. So the first 7 are true, right? The next 5 are what we call false, and then the most inferior 2, right over here, right, do not attach directly to the sternum. So these are false ribs, but since they don't have any cartilage at all, we call those floaters. So these floating ribs are false ribs, but not all false ribs are floaters, right? Okay. So when you look at that, please be aware of that. And we'll be able to finish this up next time. Okay, we don't have much more to talk about in terms of axial skeleton. Yeah. The vertebral canal is the canal that's formed by all the vertebrae when you stack them together. Okay? So when you look at one vertebrae, it's kind of hard to see. You just see the vertebral foramen. Yeah, that forms a canal.
Yeah, it's all the foramen. Foramina lined up.